Welcome to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour, where we bring you information about Minnesota's National Guard, military community, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon Program, and Department of Veteran Affairs. Your host is Tom Lyons, the founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a Twin Cities merger and acquisition advisory firm. Tom is also a Vietnam veteran of the United States Air Force and a member of the VFW and American Legion. Now the host of Minnesota Military Radio Hour, Tom Lyons.
Welcome to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. I'm Tom Lyons. In today's show, we talk to Washington County Attorney Pete Orput about a court designed to get veterans the help they need, and we take a look at World War II and the Bataan Death March with the Minnesotan who survived the experience. But first, it's time for Generally Speaking, a weekly message from the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Major General Rick Nash.
In April of 1942, a military force of 75,000 men, including almost 12,000 Americans, surrendered to Japanese forces on the Philippine island of Bataan. What followed was a tragic but heroic chapter for the American military and for the Minnesota National Guard. The men, starving and disease-ridden, were forced to march 61 miles to a Japanese prison camp. Along the way, those that were injured or unable to continue were beaten, bayoneted, and often killed by Japanese forces. Thousands died en route from disease, starvation, dehydration, heat injury, untreated wounds, and mistreatment by their captors. Including in that desperate group were soldiers from an element of the 194th Armored Regiment, now known as the Minnesota National Guard's 1st Squadron, 94th Cavalry, headquartered in Brainerd, Minnesota. To commemorate the Bataan Death March and honor the sacrifice of all who endured it, First of the 194th sponsors the annual Bataan Memorial Death March, in which representatives from around Minnesota participate. Yesterday, the Minnesota National Guard hosted the 14th annual Memorial March in Brainerd, with different race categories including a run and light and heavy rucksack marching divisions. I encourage those interested to visit MinnesotaNationalGuard.org to see photos of this community event. Though this was a grim time in World War II, it reminds us in the Minnesota National Guard of the history and tradition we uphold every day. From Gettysburg to North Africa and Italy to Iraq and Afghanistan, Minnesota National Guard soldiers and airmen have fought to protect America and her citizens. It's a tradition and lineage that we will continue to cherish and build upon as we move forward during this time of frequent deployments and persistent challenges.
Thank you, General Nash. You can link to the Adjutant General's blog, Facebook, and Twitter feed through MinnesotaNationalGuard.org/generallyspeaking. This week, Pete Orput joins us. He is a veteran of the United States Marine Corps, served in Vietnam, and he's also the Washington County Attorney and a founding member of the Veterans Court Planning Committee. Mr. Orput, welcome to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour.
Thank you, Tom, and thanks for having me.
Pete, can you tell me how you became a founding member of the Veterans Court Planning Committee?
Sure, Tom. It's been several years since I got out of the service, but I've run into, as a prosecutor, a number of veterans coming through the criminal justice system, and it seemed that some of these gentlemen, mostly men, had some unique problems that we could trace back sometimes to their combat service. And we realized that those folks needed to get those problems addressed in a sort of a special way by special folks.
So, and therefore we came up with the idea of a veterans court?
Well, the idea came up in early 2008 when another prosecutor friend of mine from Buffalo, New York, apprised me that they had set up a veterans court, and as it turns out, it was the first one in the country to address the issues I'd been talking with other prosecutors about. And in a nutshell, if I can explain that, the idea of the veterans court there, and that's become the model for a number of other ones, close to 40 now in the country, is that it's a court where everyone ideally in the courtroom is a veteran. We bring a veteran in who has had problems with the criminal justice system, that we get them diagnosed, we bring the VA in, we make available the correct services that we think will help that veteran, and with everybody in the room being a veteran, it's hard for them to play the you don't understand my reality card that a lot of them would want to play.
So this is bringing together the judge, the prosecutor, the defender, everybody in the room. If they've been to war, if they've been a veteran, now the veteran who's had some kind of trouble can't sit there and say, you don't understand.
That's correct.
And we say, yes, we can.
That's right, Tom. And what it is we also partner with the VA and some other veterans advocates. And most important for me is this also brings in civilian veterans that work as mentors with mostly, like I say, we've only had men so far in Minnesota, but perhaps we'd be available for the women veterans too. But the idea is a civilian mentor takes the responsibility to also help that veteran out while they're going through the treatment and other things that we need to do for that veteran.
Now, Pete, who's eligible for to be heard in front of a veteran court? Is this nonviolent veterans?
Yeah, in Hennepin County, we've opened it to all veterans from Hennepin County, and we're hoping to get more veterans courts in Minnesota. And the idea is they would have to have committed a crime that's less serious than one that would call for a prison sentence. If it did call for a prison sentence, we would look at it, but with some reluctance. Frankly, there are some crimes that one commits that there is no treatment for, something like a murder or a serious rape. But that's not what we've seen. We see typically a lot of these veterans, they come back from the service. And by the way, it's a small percentage of all the veterans that serve. But for those that we see, we want to be there for them. We don't want to leave them behind. And so for them, typically what we see is alcohol-related offenses, family offenses. They come home, they're having trouble getting a job, they start drinking, that leads to problems with their spouses and significant others, and or they get into driving offenses or barroom fights, those kinds of things. And to us, it seems like it's a cry for help.
We're speaking with Pete Orpett, the Washington County Attorney and founding member of the Veterans Court Planning Committee on the Minnesota Military Radio Hour here on News Talk 100.3 FM. So, Pete, let me understand what you're trying to do here. Are we trying to get to the cause of the problem? And are we assuming that maybe the cause of the problem comes directly related to service in the military?
That's correct, Tom. For those that we can identify that through, first thing we have to do is we get the veterans come through the judicial system, typically in jail, identify them as a veteran, then do the psychological screening and have the professionals there to screen them. If it turns out that that person is suffering from, say, post-traumatic stress or traumatic brain injury that seems to be linked to their criminal activity, the idea is let's hold off on prosecuting until we get them the help they need and make it available. Things such as the VA program up in St. Cloud, bring in the mentors, bring in the experts, and give them the opportunity. After 12 to 18 months, if they successfully complete that, we're willing to divert them. In other words, not give them a criminal conviction.
Do we know the results? How's the program working?
Well, we started in July. By the way, some of the pioneers are Milt Schoen, the Veteran Service Officer, and Mike Freeman, the Hennepin County Attorney, and many others. We started this in July of last year. It's currently staffed by Judge Charles Porter, who himself is a Navy veteran. And we've had 60 veterans go through, 10 more than we thought we'd get. And now we believe we might get up to 100 in 1 year. But we won't know statistically how well we're doing for about 18 months.
How about the other courts around the country?
Well, like I said earlier, the model, the Buffalo, New York model, has had a zero recidivist rate. In other words, those who go through the program and successfully complete it, we never see them again in a criminal justice system. They're back with their families, raising their kids, going to work, paying their taxes.
Zero recidivism.
It's been zero. Now, they did tell me out there that they've had three veterans choose to drop out, and that's always available. We're not compelling anybody to go through it. We're saying we're making it available.
So you've got high goals for Minnesota's Veterans Court as well.
I do, and I'm a little jealous of our neighbors in Wisconsin who've got now three Veterans Courts throughout their state. We've got one. We're about to get another one up in Pope County, and frankly, I'd like to see one in Washington County.
And how many do you think you're trying to go for in the state? It sounds like if you can shoot for that high a goal, zero recidivism.
Well, again, Tom, if we go back to what I think all of us agree on, we're not going to leave anybody behind. Both when they're in combat and when they get out. So for those who are suffering, we want to be there. And I, as a prosecutor, this is, I want to remind folks, this isn't a hug-a-thug program. It's actually fairly arduous. But the idea is if we can help them succeed in turning things around, dealing with their things like post-traumatic stress and getting back, raising their families, it's all good.
And Pete, where can listeners go for more information?
Well, I would highly recommend they call the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. They have a toll-free number and some wonderful staff. That number is 1-888-546-5838. I would also recommend any veteran out there that would like services to contact their county veteran service office. Every county in the state has a veteran service officer waiting to help them and talk about their benefits and talk about the programs that we now have for them.
Pete, we're just about out of time. Any final thoughts for our veterans?
Hang in there, boys and girls. We're here to help you.
Pete, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. I really appreciate it.
That was Pete Orpett, the Washington County Attorney and founding member of the Veterans Court Planning Committee. When we return, we'll talk about the Bataan Death March with World War II veteran Harold Curvers. That's right here on News Talk 100.3 FM. This is the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. Welcome back to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Lyons. Before we begin our conversation about the Bataan Death March, it's time for the Commissioner's Corner, a weekly update from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Now here's Commissioner Larry Shelado.
April 9th is just around the corner. While some historians may see this date and recall the end of the Civil War in 1865, April 9th holds a very different meaning for many veterans. On April 9th, 1942, U.S. Major General Edward King surrendered to the Japanese Army on the northern island of Luzon in the Philippine Islands. 10,000 American soldiers, along with thousands of Filipinos, were marched some 70 miles to a POW camp. Nearly 1,000 soldiers died from malnutrition and executions along the way. The rest faced years of brutal and deadly captivity in the Philippines and Japan. Today, April 9th, also represents former POW Recognition Day. More than 500,000 Americans have been captured and interned as prisoners of war since the American Revolution. The largest number of American POWs came during the Civil War, when an estimated 220,000 Confederate soldiers were interned by the North and nearly 127,000 Union soldiers were taken prisoner by the South. Since World War I, more than 142,000 Americans, including nearly 100 women, have been held as POWs. Today, more than 90% of Americans living POWs are World War II veterans. In their service to our country, former prisoners of war have sacrificed mightily to maintain the promise of liberty that we hold dear. This is why a grateful nation provides special benefits and care for our former prisoners of war and their families. The Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs is committed to reaching out to former POWs and letting them know about their eligibility for benefits and health care. Nearly 18,000 former POWs receive compensation benefits from the VA, but more may be eligible for compensation under special legislation presuming service connection for a variety of diseases and disorders related to the POW experience. It is vital that former POWs and their spouses realize that wartime incarceration entitles them to special consideration for VA health care and benefits. Let us vow to never forget the courage of our nation's staunchest defenders, our former prisoners of war. Let us vow to never forget the sacrifices they made so that we can enjoy the freedoms we embrace today as Americans. Here in Minnesota, I hope you will join the nation in recognizing all our former prisoners of war. It is a day to honor the extraordinary sacrifices made by these courageous veterans.
Thank you, Commissioner Shelado. You can find out more about the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs programs by calling 1-888-LINK-VET or online at minnesotaveteran.org. This week, Harold Snuffy Curvers joins us. He is a World War II veteran of the Minnesota's 194th Tank Battalion and one of the few remaining survivors of the Bataan Death March. Mr. Curvers, welcome to the Minnesota Military Radio Program.
Thank you.
Mr. Curvers, you're a lifelong Minnesotan and a native of St. Paul?
Correct. And that snuff is without the Y, please.
Snuff? All right, sir. Well, snuff, you got out of high school and were working, and then along came the draft.
Draft, yeah.
And what year were you drafted, sir?
1941, April 14th of 41.
April of 41.
Yeah.
And then you went to basic training?
Yeah, we went to Fort Snelling about 3 days, then we moved to Fort Lewis in that same week. And it was, then got the basic, very little bit training there, but that's where it was.
And that's where you joined the 194th tank?
There were 77 of us from this area. And to join them, that were most of them draftees or selectees or whatever you want to call them.
Sure. And then later that year, your unit was shipped out to the Philippines.
Mm-hmm. We went to we left Fort Lewis about in September, and we went down to Angel Island, and then left there. Went to the Philippines. I think it took us about 23 days, something like that. We were in blackout from Honolulu on. That was strange to us. And we think they suspected something at that time, because going blackout that soon, that
a little early. It was before December 7th.
It's 3 months before.
So after you got there, you were stationed at Fort Stotzenberg?
Stotzenberg.
And how was it there? This was before the war started.
It was a touch. It was the Philippines. You had a break in the afternoon. You got not that much training. It's things that we should have learned. We didn't get it. And we were there in Stotzenberg until we got hit.
And your assignment at the Fort Stotzenberg, were you a medic?
I became a medic just before we went overseas. I didn't get that much training. Just before we went overseas, they formed a medical detachment, and they had a group of them that came up from California, and they formed this unit, and they put a bunch of us draftees, and we wanted to get out. We wanted to stay with our unit, but we couldn't do it. We had to stay. They told us there were three of us that went up there to try to get the exchange, stay back in the headquarters company, and they said the only way we could get out of that was taking a short discharge and re-enlist for 3 years. And he said, no, we'll take this.
So after they assigned you as a medic, little training?
Very little training. We had a group of good ones that came up from some other area. They formed a detachment there, medical detachment at Fort Lewis. They were well-trained, but there was a handful of us that went in there. We had no training whatsoever.
And this was before the war started. So what were you treating the troops for?
Malaria, whatever, yeah.
And were you driving an ambulance?
I most of my time was either I can't think of the name of the car. It's a recon or something it was called, and the ambulance. Yeah, there were three of us that were assigned to that.
Did any of your fellows or partners think that the war was imminent?
No. We had a fellow. The day before, he says they wouldn't dare touch us. They wouldn't dare. He never heard the end of that.
I suppose he didn't.
He never heard the end.
So until the war started, it was pretty good duty then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was great. I mean, there was talk of rumors of it, but we didn't. But like I said, I could quote the man's name, McKeon, Bill McKeon. He was, in fact, he could have been out. He could have gotten out. He was over that 28 mark at that time. But he stayed in. He says, well, he's going to put it in with these men for quite a while. He's going to stay.
And as we all know, on December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor was bombed by the Japanese.
Yeah. And we heard about it. It was noon to us. All of our planes were up in the air at that time. And they came back and went settled in I can't think of the name of the field now, but anyway, they were caught on the ground right at, they were out at lunch.
Was that at Clark Field?
Clark Field, yeah. It was Clark.
And were you up at Clark at that time?
We were at Stotzenberg. We were at Fort Stotzenberg was the name of the camp, yeah.
And so Clark Field was bombed on the same day, December 7th?
Yeah. To us, it was across the date line. It was the 8th to us.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it was the same time.
The same time, yeah. It was right at noon on the 8th.
And once they started that bombing, then what happened to your unit?
They pulled us out and said, we heard that Pearl had been hit. So they took us and put us around Clark Field. I don't know what good all I was carrying was a .45. What good am I with a .45, But I can remember the planes, they had us surrounding Clark Field. And I can remember looking up, and the planes came, a beautiful formation, and we were mentioning the fact of what a beautiful formation. And somebody says, I wonder whose they are. And then we found out.
And they weren't ours.
They start dropping them, yeah.
We've been speaking with Harold Curvers, a World War II veteran and one of the few remaining survivors of the Bataan Death March, on the Minnesota Military Radio Hour here on News Talk 100.3. We have to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about what happened after the United States troop had to surrender at Bataan. This is the Minnesota Military Radio Hour on News Talk 100.3 FM. Welcome back to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. Today we're talking to Harold Curvers, a World War II veteran of Minnesota's 194th Tank Battalion and one of the few remaining survivors of the Bataan Death March. Mr. Curvers, we've been talking about how you enlisted in the service and went to boot camp and were assigned to the 194th and then off to the Philippines.
Yeah.
And things were pretty good until December 7th, 1941. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and they also attacked Clark Field and came after you. And you spent the next 5 months then fighting the Japanese until April 9th, 1942. How did that all go? Were you moving all the time?
We moved around the island quite a bit. We were up in Lingayen for a while, and I was, like I said, I was assigned to this tank battalion, and they were moved from one area to another. We went to the southern part of it. And then we went across. In fact, I came down with a dengue fever, and I was in the hospital when the unit moved it to Bataan. And when I came out of that, they shipped me across the bay, Manila Bay, to Bataan, and I joined the outfit then. They had already moved back in there.
Philippine and the United States forces were being pushed back into that peninsula of Bataan.
Yeah. Yeah, and then we moved out of there and then went back in there again. We were moved around quite a bit. And like most people will say, guys that were there, said the tanks were useless. The terrain, it was not, not conducive for tanks.
So the war wasn't going well?
No, no.
Now how were your supplies and their food and water?
We were hungry all the time.
Hungry all the time?
Yeah. In fact, I had a ring that my girlfriend at the time had given me, and I had trouble keeping it on. And just as I'm going ahead of time here, but then when the Japs got it, after the surrender, he took it away from me.
Mm-hmm. So the war wasn't going well. You were being pushed back into the peninsula.
Yeah.
5 months of fighting, not much food, not much water.
That's the part of, lack of food. I think... I would guess most of us lost 20, 25 pounds before the surrender. I was in pretty good shape when I went in. I was played a little baseball, and it was good shape. I weighed about 150, 55 pounds or whatever, and I was down about 100. We had no scales, so there was no way but just the way the clothing fit on you and the things were, the combs, the rings were loose.
So a real tough month, five months of fighting. And then on
April 9th, it was...
April 9th, 1942, Major General Edward King surrendered.
Surrendered the group, yeah.
And at the time he did that, I understand there were about 11,000 United States troops and somewhere around 70,000 Filipinos.
Yeah, it was them poor Filipinos. They went in there the day the war broke out. No training whatsoever. It was a shame. It was a shame that...
And once you heard that the general had surrendered... what did you do then? Were you ordered to do something with your weapons?
Yeah, we destroy everything, and that was a bad shot because we could have used the vehicles to get out of there. We had nothing to come out. So maybe if we'd had those vehicles, we wouldn't have been marching. I don't know if we'd had enough to take care of that many troops, but somebody could have, you know, gone out on with them, you know.
But you destroyed the tanks and the weapons and the trucks and destroyed everything.
Ammunition, everything.
And that's when the Bataan Death March began.
Yeah. And we never thought of it as a march. We always thought of it as a hike out of Bataan, you know.
And what kind of shape were you in at the beginning of that?
I would guess I dropped about 15 pounds or something, because everything on me was loose, and my clothing, and it was, you know, that ring, like I mentioned, the ring was almost ready to drop off.
So before the march ever even started, you were tired and beat up.
Beat all the time. No rest, you know.
Hungry and thirsty.
All the time, yeah.
Now, did the Japanese separate the Filipinos from the Americans?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, they had them going up into different groups.
So all the Americans were together.
The Americans were together, yeah. And we were never around any Filipinos. I don't remember seeing them at any time going up out of Bataan.
So that began the 60-mile death march.
That's what they say, the number of miles. That, you know, the distance wasn't the problem. So the conditions we were in when we started is the problem.
Was it hot weather?
Yeah.
90 degrees?
Whatever. Yeah, we would have no way of knowing, you know, what the degrees were, but it was hot.
You were already worn out and...
Oh, beat.
And then you had to go on this hike.
Yeah.
And did that...
And we referred to it as a hike. No one ever talked to it as a march, because it was a long call from a march, you know.
And it was a slow gait.
It's a slow gait, yeah. We had guards with us that were... You know, I come from a neighborhood where you're well-educated in that respect, and I noticed that they belted somebody that was close to them, and I was never around them, ever. I was always in the middle. I stayed away from their sides. And that was Rice Street education, I was thought.
So you kept your head down and stayed out of
the
way.
Stayed away from them. Didn't try to deal with them. Didn't try to get any water from them. So many guys did try that, you know, get something from our trade their watches and everything. I was never around them.
And they got themselves in trouble, didn't they?
Yes, they did, yeah.
Now, the historians tell us that about 10,000 Americans started and you lost about 1,000 along the way.
About that, yeah.
So was that a disease and malnutrition?
I saw bodies. I never once saw shooting or bayoneting, but I saw the bodies there that had been. We were about the first ones out of Bataans, so we didn't have the chance to see what was happening to the rest of them that followed us.
So you were at the front of the group.
We were the last one to go into Bataan, so our unit. So we were the first one out of there. And I don't remember ever seeing anybody shot or killed, but I saw some bodies lying there. You know, there's one body that stays in my mind, I don't know why, and I don't know whether it was Filipino or American, but he was sitting, leaning against a tree, pitch black. I don't know what nationality or anything, but I remember that stays in my crowd as long as I think of it.
Not a good memory.
No.
So, Mr. Kerber, do you have any idea how long did it take you to cover that 60 miles?
I was guessing either 5, 6, 7 days. I can't remember it.
But real tough days?
Yeah.
Did they give you any food or water?
No. See, that's what we were hustling for all the way up, trying to do it. We were taking chances. We were digging. It was quite moist underground there. You dig down, you get a little moisture in there. And we were digging down in it. I don't know if anybody got sick from that, you know. But if a stream of water, they'd start going to that, and you never know if anybody used that to eliminate themselves, you know.
Sure.
And they were drinking that water. I never went to that. I went to everything off the side of that.
We're speaking with Harold Kerbers, a World War II veteran and one of the few remaining survivors of the Bataan Death March, on the Minnesota Military Radio Hour here on News Talk 100.3 FM. Mr. Kerbers, you've said it took you 6, 7, 8 days to march those 60 miles.
I can't remember that. I don't think it was 8. I think it was 5, 6, something like that.
And you were headed for which camp?
O'Donnell was the name of the first camp. Capus was the name of the town. And then we went to I was there maybe 4, 5, 6. Time, you don't
gets
remember half the things. Then they were taken to O'Donnell.
And how were the conditions there?
Oh, it was terrible. They had 40, 50 bodies out there every day. It's Americans.
The Americans that died each day.
And you know what was strange about that? I used to go out and see if any of them from our outfit that I might know. And I don't know what it was, and I didn't think of it until years later. I noticed that there was a lot of them were redheads that were lying there. Say there were 40 bodies out there. It seemed like about 20 of them or so would be either blondes or redheads. It seems like that complexion couldn't take that temperature, that heat or whatever.
The heat and the malaria and the beriberi and so forth.
So since coming back, I've gone to different conventions, and if I see a person who would, they're gray now, but if they were, looked like they might have been blonde or red, I'd go up and say, were you in Bataan? They'd always say, no, it was Craigdart. I never ran into one.
And during your time on the march and during your time at Camp O'Donnell, was it your faith that helped you get through this?
A lot of praying. A lot of begging.
And you've made it all the way to 92.
Yeah.
So it must work pretty well.
It did work real well.
And did they move you from camp to camp once you got to O'Donnell?
No, I stayed in that one camp all the while. A lot of guys volunteered to go to Japan, and two of my friends, three of them, wanted to go, and I said, things get tough. It's going to be worse up there. You're going to be in with those people. I don't want part of that, you know. But I finally ended up in, probably been better off if I'd gone earlier because I wouldn't run into the problems I did.
And so you were at O'Donnell for most of the time?
From 42 until 44. We went to a prison in Manila. It was called Bilibid Prison. And I spent about 3 months there before we shipped out. And then to 49 days of hell on that ship. That was the worst 49 days of my life.
Mr. Curvers, we have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about how you got from there to Japan. We're speaking with Harold Curvers, a World War II veteran and one of the few remaining survivors of the Bataan Death March, on the Minnesota Military Radio Hour here on Newstalk 100.3 FM. Welcome back to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. Today we're talking to Harold Curvers, a World War II veteran of Minnesota's 194th Tank Battalion and one of the few remaining survivors of the Bataan Death March. Harold has been explaining to us that he's a native of St. Paul, and he was drafted in 1941, assigned to the 194th Tank Battalion, went to the Philippines, and when World War II started on December 7th, all hell broke loose at the Philippines at Clark Field, and they fought through April 9th of 1942 and then walked the Bataan Death Hike from Bataan over to the Japanese camps. Mr. Curvers, you were there for a couple of years, and then did you volunteer to be moved to Japan,
they come and got me. There was 1619, I think, was the count of that ship, and we had a hunch we were going to be in trouble because they had bombed there before, you know. And while we were there, we were in the commanded and Bilibid prison for quite a while too. Commanded one first for a couple of years, and then Bilibid prison for about 6 weeks. And we knew that we were going to be in trouble when because they had a number of ships that were our ships that were in the harbor that our planes had sunk, and so we knew it was going to be a rough road. And sure enough, it was. We were in Bilibid as a prison in Manila. We were there about a month, I think. It's tough going back. It's remembering the exact time.
So they were staging you there until the ship was ready to take you to Japan.
Yeah. In fact, a couple times they were ready, and that ship was sunk. It was in the bay. It was sunk before it could take us down then. And finally, we went down, and I should remember the date. I do remember it, and I can't come up with it now. But and they took us down, and we got on, and the very first, next day we got hit. We got hit about planes came over about three or four times. We got hit three different times. We sunk in Subic Bay, and that's where it was we gave the first hit to, right up in there.
So the Japanese packed these ships?
You couldn't hardly move.
And you got underway, and the American plane sunk the ship?
Sunk the ship, yeah.
But how many survived off that ship then?
Well, that first raid, we lost 400. Was 1,600 or something, and we got off with about 1,200, and they took us up to a tennis court up in Luzon, kept us there for a couple of days, and brought us back to Subic Bay, and then we got on another ship.
And how packed was that ship?
I was fortunate. I thought there was only about 90 on it, but when the stories come out, they said there was 240, but the rest of them were packed in the other ship. And those people, there's one of the fellows I know, and I see him a lot. He had, I think he had a little difficult time believing that I wasn't with him, that we were on another ship. It was, I thought it was only about 40, 50, because when we were jammed in there with that 1,600, when you go to just a handful, you think it's small, but it was, they say it was 240. So I thought it was only about 50.
And what happened to that second ship, sir?
We got hit on that too, and I can remember saying, "No, God, not again." And by the time we got to Formosa, there was a list to the ship, and I can't remember from starboard to port. It was listing. It was in our condition. It was a difficult time to walk from starboard to port to starboard. I can't remember which. And then we got off it, and I remember turning around, looking at it, and it was a big blast in the side of that. We didn't lose anybody. But I remember being on that thing, and I remember saying, not again. And I remember the ship just jarred, you know, trembling or whatever. And but we made it all the way to Formosa then.
And then you were on the third ship before you could get to Japan.
Yeah, on the fourth. For us, it was four. The third ship for 200 of us.
Oh, my God.
Some of the guys that were at the other, they don't believe. They didn't know about us guys. In fact, I worked with one of them. He didn't believe it until I found a story, and I gave it to him, and he believes me now, you know.
And once you got to Japan, then where did they send you then?
The first thing, I ended up in a hospital. I was in a bad way. In fact, I think being an optimist, this is my thinking. I didn't think of dying. I was thinking, am I going to make it? And I think that's a different means of thinking, you know. I was in a bad way, and it was a guy from Minneapolis, a medic from Minneapolis, McDonald. I heard screaming after I come out of starting to realize I'm going to make it. I heard somebody screaming, and I asked Mac. I says, "Mac, what's that screaming?" He says, "This guy." He tried to get some word from the Koreans that were in the mine. He was trying to get some news from them about how the war was going, and the Japanese turned him in, the workers turned him into the guards, and they put him in the ASO, it's called the jail, and they beat him. And I heard that every hour. It was either the intervals were every hour, every 2 hours, I'd hear the screaming. And him screaming, and then this medic told me that they were every hour they beat him, and they had he was holding a canteen up above his head, and not canteen, some water up and over his head, and he was that way for an hour, and he's on his knees with a rifle keep him from relaxing, from sitting down. And he was that way with the intervals were every hour, every 2 hours, I heard the screaming. And that's when I asked McDonald, this guy was from Minneapolis, I said, what's the, and then he told me that this guy had tried to get the information about how the war was going. And he was turned into the guards, and that was his punishment.
Mr. Kervers, you survived years as a POW under terrible conditions. Was it your faith and your sense of humor that got you through it?
Yeah, that we always said that about 99% of the guys had a good sense of humor that come back. Yeah,
the ones that survived.
Yeah, and I don't know if they all, but some we had guys that became Catholics and left it right in during the 2 years we were there. You know, so we don't know what he's going to have all the answers. You know,
he will. Mr. Curvers, when you heard about the end of the war, I understand that when they transported you out, you went through Nagasaki?
Yes, yeah.
And what did you see there?
It was miserable. Oh. The stench stayed with me. Wait, not anymore, but it was with me for a while. I don't know if it's bodies or what, but it was a horrible stench. And we looked around, and we saw a hands full of bodies. I looked around and saw some people going around, looking for whatever they could find in it. But I thought the whole city had gone. But since then, I worked with a fellow that went through there after the war, and he said not all of a sudden Nagasaki was burnt out. He said parts of it, the north of it, or whatever direction, I can't remember. I can remember two stacks, and I don't know what they consisted of, but one looked like it was perfectly normal. It could have been cracked up because it was a distance. And the other one, the proximity of that to the other stack, was up like three-quarters of the way up and then leaning. It was tilted. And I couldn't see the cracks in it, so I don't know what the damage it was done on, but it was a strange-looking sight. You think everything else was gone, but these two stacks were.
And I understand you were put aboard a USS Destroyer on the way home. And when you got home, how long did it take you to recover from years of this malnutrition?
Well, I spent a year in a hospital. I came back. And I spent a year in Glen Lake. In fact, I got married there.
And then you came out and you served our country as a post office for 36 years.
Yeah, gave my all.
Mr. Curvers, we're almost out of time. Do you have any final thoughts for our listeners about World War II and the Bataan Death March and the terrible things you went through?
Just to people who believe in God, pray for peace.
That's an awfully good thought at the end of the show, sir.
Yeah.
Mr. Curvers, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Harold Curvers, a World War II veteran of the Minnesota's 194th Tank Battalion and one of the few remaining survivors of the Bataan Death March. We have links to more information on Facebook and at MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com. Before we go, for all our Red Bulls and fans of World War II history, this Thursday, April 14th, the World War II History Roundtable topic will be the Battle of Monte Cassino. General Jack Vesey, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, will be on hand to recount his experience as a 22-year-old first sergeant in that historic battle. For details on this and other events happening around the state, visit us at facebook.com/Minnesota Military Radio Hour. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this week, Pete Orput from Washington County, World War II and Bataan Death March survivor Harold Curvers, Commissioner Larry Shelladoe, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and finally, Minnesota's Adjutant General, Major General Rick Nash. Please join us next week as we talk about the Yellow Ribbon community of Spring Lake Park and the deployment of Minnesota's 374th Engineers. That's next Sunday morning at 7, right here on News Talk 100.3 FM. I'm Tom Lyons, and I hope that you make a difference in someone's life this week.
You've been listening to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour with host Tom Lyons. Tom is the founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a merger and acquisition advisory firm located in Minneapolis. He's also a Vietnam veteran of the United States Air Force. We hope you found this program to be informative and entertaining. This has been a production of KTLK, Clear Channel, MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com, the Minnesota National Guard, BeyondTheYellowRibbon.org, and the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs. Podcasts of this program are available at MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com. Thanks for listening.